This is a Brain Channel program from the Department of Neurosciences at the UC San Diego School of Medicine. Visit us at uctv.tv/brain to explore cutting-edge research, treatment options for conditions related to the nervous system, and the inner workings of the human mind.
I thought I would give you an update on magnetic vestibular stimulation because it now has some clinical implications, and I can tell you where we're going research-wise, and it's really a great story. So I'm going to tell you who I work with first, and as always, these are the key people. Prem Jariasintasan was a medical student with us who came over from England and has done a lot of work with us recently. Dale is a computer engineer and sorted this all out for us by doing some physics experiments. Brian and Grace are ENT residents. Michael is a physical therapist in ENT, and Jorge is an engineer working with us. So this really is a collaborative group. Now we're working with physicists, I'll tell you why at the end, to develop a new kind of MRI stimulator. So it's always a good idea to give you the take-home messages before, in case anybody gets tired or falls asleep. But everybody, and that includes humans, mice, zebras, fish, developed nystagmus and or postural abnormalities in an MRI machine from the magnetic field itself. It has nothing to do with making pictures or images. And it's due to this property of magnetic fields and ionic fluids which have ionic currents in them called Lorentz forces or magnetohydrodynamic forces. And these forces act on the ion-carrying endolymph within the inner ear semicircular canals. So basically, magnetic fields stimulate the labyrinth. And it's a large effect the bigger the scanner gets. And I'm going to give you a lot of implications for this. It becomes a very simple, safe, comfortable, albeit expensive if you want to rent time on a 7T magnet, tool to elicit a sustained vestibular imbalance lasting hours while you're in the scanner. And it allows us to study the functional anatomy of the vestibular system and visual vestibular interaction, how the brain adapts to a vestibular imbalance, and this has implications for all kinds of adaptations. I'll focus on that sort of at the end of this talk. It's a way to study vestibular perception, the effects of drugs and therapies on the vestibular system, genetic manipulations in animals, development. And what we're excited now is about using this as a potential technique for rehabilitation, for balance, as well as for higher level cognitive disorders, such as inattention, neglect, those kinds of things. And a caveat, if you read a paper about functional imaging or resting state connectivity, you should be aware that there can be artifacts induced by the fact that there is no such thing as resting state with an MRI machine. And especially now that we know everybody is getting vestibular excitation, the cerebellum is excited, vestibular projection areas are excited, just from the nystagmus itself, whether you see it or not, it's inside the brain. And that's going to have potentially implications for your interpretation of a functional MRI tests. Well, I was a subject for an hour and a half in a functional MRI study. We were studying eye movements, vergence, and I knew at the end of that hour and a half, the only thing that the brain was interested in and was discharging with was the size of my bladder. And these were pain receptors. So, beware of functional imaging. So one little bit of vestibular physiology, you have to remember when we turn our head, we are able to sense that movement because we have a fluid flow inside the lateral semicircular canal, in the case of a horizontal movement, and that bends this structure called the cupula, which leads to bending of hair cells, their discharge changes, and that's how the brain knows that you've rotated your head. Now, the canals, by virtue of their mechanical properties, respond to the acceleration of the head. And the mechanical properties inside the labyrinth dictate that the position of the cupula is going to be proportional to head velocity. So the canals respond to acceleration, but but the cupula and the bending of the hair cells and discharge rate is going to be proportional to velocity. So if you wanted to have keep the cupula deviated and produce a constant nystagmus, a constant velocity nystagmus, you would have to accelerate the head constantly. So faster and faster and faster. Can't do that for very long, but you can do it with a magnetic field. So we are simulating a head acceleration. That's the main point. So this all kind of began with a discussion that I had with a colleague in Siena, an ENT doctor, Vincenzo Marcelli, who actually made the original observation when trying to do functional imaging studies that patients, normal subjects, when they got in the scanner, he was recording their eye movements, they actually had nystagmus before he did anything. And he speculated, this was in a 1.5 Tesla magnet, he speculated that this was due to the magnetic field. We decided to study this. An MRI machine is nothing but a big magnet, an expensive magnet. This is one 7 Tesla magnet we have at the Kennedy Krieger Institute at Hopkins. And the key point here is, and people had known for 20 years that if you walked near a very, or were in a very high field magnet, you felt dizzy. All technicians will tell you that. Talk to your technicians who do patients in 3T scanners, and they will tell you that when they're in the scanner or put their head near it, they can feel transiently dizzy. So this has been known for 20 years, but no one has known the mechanism. The key was a little clinical dictum that we have, that if you want to see a nystagmus from the periphery, you have to eliminate fixation. So we put these goggles on our patients. They were MRI compatible, and we could record their eye movements in the dark. This essentially is a Romberg test. It's the Romberg test of the eyes. You know, normally we close our eyes, and if we fall over, we know something's wrong with our posterior columns or our vestibular system. This is the same principle, but just using it for the eyes. So this is what this nystagmus looks like in a 7T magnet in a normal subject. Now, the subject is just outside the bore, but there's already a significant magnetic field, 0.5 to 1 Tesla or so, or a little more, just even before you go in the bore, because these 7 Tesla magnets are stronger. I emphasize this also happens, but slightly lesser in degree in a 3 Tesla magnet. This is what the nystagmus looks like. So we're moving into the bore. It takes about 30 seconds to get into the bore. And then, I mean, this is a real nystagmus. Can anybody see the nystagmus? Right. This is a real nystagmus. This is a 40 degrees per second. Now, this is a prize pupil, one of our colleagues, actually. But that value can range, depending upon head orientation, from 10 to 40 degrees per second. And this goes on and on and on. There is some adaptation, which I'll talk about. But this goes on for a couple hours at least. Okay, so here's what a nystagmus trace looks like. This is a recording. Here's the position of the eye. Here's time. And the red line shows you the slow phase, the drift, and the quick resetting movement, or the quick phases. And, of course, the parameter of interest is a slow phase velocity, the slope of that position trace. Yeah. So when you go into the magnet, you'll feel a sense of rotation and a peculiar sense of tilt. The perception actually goes away relatively quickly. So there's a marked association with the perception after the initial phase. I'll show you. It doesn't have anything to do with the moving into it. It's the static field, but it gradually subsides over a minute. And we just wrote a little paper about one patient who had neurosurgery, and they I think they went through the nose for a pituitary, and she had a post-op scan, and she went in there, and she got so sick from the vertigo that she began vomiting and opened up her leak, and they had to fix that. So occasionally, you know, this can be quite an abnormal perception with nausea. Okay, so this is a recording of the nystagmus, and we're going to see a few of these, because that's our measure of what the eyes are doing. So here's slow phase velocity here. This is time. Now, this is seconds, so we're already up to, 10 minutes here. And here's the patient goes in the bore, and this shows you the change in magnetic field as you're moving in the bore. And again, it's a slow rise to a sustained peak, just like a constant acceleration on a chair. But then there's some adaptation here. But then it kind of plateaus out, at least for this duration. And when they come out of the bore, you see a big after effect. This is the adaptation now has to go away. It's like we talked about this last night. It's like rebound nystagmus in patients with cerebellar disease. It's the after effect. Okay, this is a subject in for 24 hours. 24 minutes, sorry. That would really be a bladder challenge. And you can see here's the nystagmus, and it kind of fades away, but reasonably sustained. Here's the after effect. Same basic principle. So adaptation is reflected in the decrease of the nystagmus in the magnet and the reversal of nystagmus when out of the magnet. These are adaptation after effects. So, I'm sorry, the nystagmus what?
Disappears. So the adaptation leads to disappearance of the
nystagmus. So if we've only had people in for a couple hours and it's not completely gone, so we don't know. But we know from the clinical work, if you do a labyrinthectomy and wait about 6 or 7 days, the nystagmus is largely gone. So we don't have any definite evidence about what happens after a couple hours yet.
Is this all with goggles,
today? So the goggles allow us to see the nystagmus.
Is all this data with goggles?
Yeah. Okay. Because if you don't have the goggles, well, I mean, the goggles you could still record, but if you have fixation, the nystagmus is gone because we'll suppress it. It's inside. It's going on. You know, we're suppressing it. But these are all recordings. So we took a couple of patients who have no labyrinthine function and nothing happened. So we think this is very likely due to the stimulation of an intact labyrinth. We put them in a couple times in different head positions to make sure there was no peculiarity. So we think it's due to the labyrinth. So, you know, there are lots of things, lots of ways magnetic fields can affect biological tissues and magnetic susceptibility, Faraday forces. We're going to come down on this Lorentz forces here as the mechanism. When I talk about this to the medical students, I tell them how important and how exciting physics is for clinical medicine. So it works fairly well, I guess. All right. Now, we did a series of very simple, almost like Mr. Wizard television experiments to sort out what's going on. So remember, if you're in there for 25 minutes, the nystagmus does decay, but it appears to plateau, although I'm going to tell you later there's a slow decline that's still going on here. We put the normal subject in different strength magnets, and the nystagmus scales with the static magnetic field. So 3 Tesla, 7 Tesla, you can see the nystagmus is much greater here. Now, if we put the subject in at different, move them in and out of the magnet at different rates, no difference in the nystagmus. Here, here, here. So it's related to static effects, not subject velocity and dynamic effects. And if we just put them in and take them right out quickly, there's no after effect. So putting all this together with one other very important point, we put patients in head first versus feet first. Or we put them in the back of the magnet and the direction of the nystagmus changed. So MVS, magnetic vestibular stimulation, is sensitive to magnetic field polarity. So this helps us rule out things like diamagnetic effects. Now, or magnetic susceptibility, which is not polarity sensitive. Now, I put the Italian flag up there because At first, we were a little puzzled because in Italy, the nystagmus was always left beating, and our magnet, it was always right beating. And the answer, it took about a day to figure this out, but the bottom line is different companies make their magnets with the head at the North Pole or the head at the South Pole of the magnet. So it depended on what your company is, whether you would have a left beating or a right beating nystagmus, because they just make their magnets differently. Okay, so let me just summarize this. It's static, it's polarity sensitive, it's not related to transiently induced voltages of Faraday forces, it's not due to magnetic susceptibility, and if you know a little bit about such things, which I guess we've had to do here, if you have a current flowing vertically through a liquid, it'll experience a force, right-hand rule, orthogonal to that, and it'll produce a force in the fluid. So a guy named Zeeman discovered this. He actually won the Nobel Prize, not for this, but for something else. So this Dutchman had figured out about these Lorentz forces a long time ago. All right, so that's our hypothesis. Well, does it make any sense with respect to how the labyrinth works and how the labyrinth is organized anatomically? So here's our semicircular canals, our cochlea, the eighth cranial nerve, our utricle and saccule. And here's the lateral canal here. Here's the ampulla. It's where the fluid comes out into the vestibule. And here's the utricle sitting right there, and this is going to be an important point. Okay, here's the eighth nerve. So here's the key physiology here. So we have a current in the endolymph fluid, and the main current actually is coming from the utricle, the hair cells in the utricle. So here's our utricle. It's not stimulating the utricle that's important, you know, like for linear accelerations, but it just so happens that this utricle sits here, right next to the opening to the lateral canal here, and so there's this big ionic current flowing in this direction into the utricle, and then you have a magnetic field which is just happens to be pushing the force into the lateral canal. So it's almost like a coincidence, but that's how it works. So a utricular current in a magnetic field produces a force, pushes on the fluid, pushes the cupula, just like you if you had a natural head acceleration, and produces the nystagmus. So the endolymph, it serves a dual purpose. It's a potassium-rich fluid that fills the vestibular labyrinth. It transmits the ionic current into the hair cells in the utricle, and also in a smaller way into the hair cells that go into the cupula. And it transmits the force as a pressure onto the cupula, which is the ear's rotational sensor. So the canal is a conduit that channels the Lorentz force in the endolymph onto the cupula. Direct excitation of the utricle is not the mechanism, it is the cupula movement. So that was our hypothesis. Is there any evidence for this? What is the source and path by which a horizontal nystagmus could be produced? I'd sort of explain that to you. But also, are these forces really strong enough to cause a huge nystagmus like that? So again, here's our utricle, here's our lateral canal, and the answer is the anatomy and the geometry is okay. Now, what about the forces? Well, we know how many hair cells there are in the utricle. We know how much current, roughly, each hair cell has in picoamps, and we know how much cupular pressure there would be in a 7 Tesla magnet in terms of pascals. And the bottom line, there is plenty of Lorentz force to produce that kind of nystagmus. Now, summarize, strong magnetic fields interact with weak naturally occurring ionic currents flowing into hair cells to produce a constant force. The force pushes on the cupula, just like a sustained rotational acceleration of the head, and causes a constant nystagmus if fixation is removed. All right, the last question we had to ask, are all these directions correct? So we got to look more carefully at the geometrical relationships between the orientation of the canals and the utricle. So we took our patients, normal subjects, and we moved them into the magnet with the head in a different orientation, just kept them in there. And eventually, when we were able to pitch the head far enough forward, this is statically, the nystagmus reversed direction. So this fits nicely with our model. all patients' subjects will have a null somewhere. So theoretically, you could get, depending upon how you position the patient's head, you will get or not get nystagmus. This could be useful for functional imaging studies, for example, if you measured this. These are all of our subjects, and you can see how, as the chin goes forward and forward, the nystagmus eventually will change direction. Okay, so I won't spend a lot of time on this, but just to show you, if you can visualize this, you're lying in the scanner, and you have your utricles here, and then you have a magnetic field going like this, and you have a utricular current, which is very close to parallel, and it's producing a force like this. And so when you flip the chin up or down, you're flipping the relative directions of the magnetic field and the current, and the fluid pressure changes direction, which is the red here. So chin down, chin up. Anyway, the pressure changes direction depending upon the orientation of the ionic currents relative to the magnetic field. So that's the, yeah. Yeah, the utricle probably, the utricle. That raises another issue, and that is there was a lot of variability there in where this null was in normal subjects. So there's about 20 or 30 degrees just comes from the fact that our bony labyrinths are different in all of us. But what people haven't really thought about too much, and that is the utricle, the membranous labyrinth, also is quite variable. So, but theoretically, we should be able to image these people, find their null position, and know where their utricle is. Exactly right. So this story that I just gave you was sort of published a few years back. I've already told you that about this patient who had a CSF leak that was opened up by vomiting induced in an MRI magnetic field. But I must tell you that by far the most common cause of vertigo in patients who have an MRI scan is not what they experience in. They may feel a little dizzy, but they often can get a positional vertigo syndrome after they get home because they've been lying flat for an hour and a half, and these little stones that cause positional vertigo kind of get stuck in the wrong place. All right, the next part of the talk is some new data, and we took a bunch of patients who had loss of function on one side, more or less to test our hypothesis, because we wanted to know which parts of the labyrinth were really generating this force. And as predicted, because the anterior canal also opens up near the lateral canal, unilateral patients show a vertical component, and I'm going to show you that. The direction of the vertical component depends upon which labyrinth is affected. Theoretically, you could use this for a diagnostic test if you wanted to. And again, it's because of the opening of the superior anterior canal as well as the lateral canal is close to the utricle. So here's our superior canal. Here's our lateral canal. Here's our utricle. The posterior canal is quite far away, but these two canals are pretty close. So we could test that. So here's a patient who's lost function on one side, a unilateral loss of function on the left side. And outside the bore, there's a little horizontal nystagmus again, which there can often be because there's still a magnetic field before you actually go in the bore. And now, in the bore, you see that big upbeating nystagmus? The eyes. So a big vertical component. You don't get that in normal subjects because the two sides balance the vertical components out. So that's what we could see in a unilateral patient. And just pay attention to this little part here. Here is our, here's our utricular current. Okay, the magnetic field is here. And you can see how this fluid flow is strong in the lateral canal, but also there's some in the vertical canals, but because of the way they're oriented, one is excited, the other is inhibited. And you put all this together using some good old-fashioned physiology from the 19th century. These great masters of the labyrinth, Lorenz, Ewald, and Breuer, they figured out what each canal does in terms of nystagmus direction by working on pigeons. And we could use this little scheme, which is the same scheme we use to diagnose patients with nystagmus in different directions. We could use this little scheme to figure out what we were seeing in the MRI machine. Ewald has these laws, which we use for clinical reasons. Don't need to go into them now. The main point is, if you stimulate a canal, you get an eye movement that's in the plane of that canal. So we take this geometrical model plus the patterns of canal stimulation, and we can then figure out that Ewald's law predicts the exact pattern that we should see in normals and in patients with unilateral loss of function. Now, there was one thing that didn't fit, and that was normals should have some torsion. And that was very hard to see on our original videos, but we got a little bit of a better video system with a higher resolution, and now you can see that normals get a little bit of torsion as well. So all this nicely confirms the hypothesis. Like all good hypotheses, we've spent a lot of time trying to disprove it. Haven't successfully done that. Okay. So Ewald's law explains the pattern in a left-sided loss patient and a right-sided loss patient. If you've lost the right labyrinth, you should get downbeat nystagmus. If you've lost the left labyrinth, you should get upbeat nystagmus, and that's exactly what we found. Okay, so what about animal models? This is a mouse in a strong 11 Tesla magnet. This is a roaring nystagmus. And now we have a nice way to assay labyrinthine function in mice, genetically manipulated mice, mice who've been given ototoxic medicines. But we were very amazed that the nystagmus was so strong, although there is quite an adaptation here. And curiously, why would a nystagmus be so much greater in a mouse than in a human? And actually, Lorenz forces predict that exactly. They predict that with a smaller vestibular system, they will experience a vestibular stimulation equivalent to a larger head acceleration. And that's because Lorenz forces scale with the first power of the canal size, and head rotation forces scales with the second power, the square of the canal size. So depending upon how you're put together in terms of canal size, you're going to have a different nystagmus. Now, we've been working with zebrafish. And here's some little zebrafish kind of floating around outside a strong magnet. And then we put them in the magnet. Now, they're not immobilized, of course, and they start swimming. This could be, this is kind of the Olympics for zebrafish, I guess we could call this. So now we have a nice assay in zebrafish for vestibular function. This is actually like a tail nystagmus, if you will, rather than a eye nystagmus. You can immobilize these animals with gel agar and actually measure their tail movements. You know, everything I'm saying applies to the vestibulospinal system as well. Okay, so you can measure the paths that the zebrafish follows before going in the magnet, after the magnet, coming out. So you actually can quantify some of their behavior. Their zebrafish are a great model for everything, of course, but you can study all kinds of things with this this functional biological method. All right, so before I get to the last part, I want to repeat a little bit of what I said earlier. Everybody gets nystagmus in an MRI machine unless they happen to be in that neutral head position. And we're going to concentrate now on this. I mentioned you can study vestibular perception, drugs and therapies. We'll talk a little bit about rehabilitation in the end. And again, a caveat, watch out for your interpretation of functional imaging studies, because the vestibular system is active. And you know the vestibular system projects to virtually every part of the cerebral cortex. We need to know where we are for any kind of action that has to be performed in the case of you know, some environmental disturbance. So there are vestibular projections to the frontal lobe, parietal lobe, temporal lobe, everywhere. The brain has to know where you are. Okay, so the last part, I'm going to talk a little bit about homeostasis and what we call set point or bias adaptation. So this is a little simple model for homeostasis. It could be, you know, controlling the temperature in our house or controlling, you know, body temperature, anything, hunger, etc. So something happens in the world. We have a receptor, a sensor, and that's a new signal to what controls the output. If there's an air signal, like if the temperature is too high or too low, that activates the effector, turns on or turns off your heat pump, and that the response is fed back to the receptor, and when there's no air, the thing goes off. Okay. So, you know, Claude Bernard really first put this on the map, and then Walter Cannon in the autonomic system, this idea of homeostasis. So they're pervasive in nature, homeostatic mechanisms. Even the control of the mechanical cytoskeleton inside each cell are homeostatic mechanisms. Segmental reflex arcs at the spinal cord level and the highest levels of cognition and emotional state. We need a certain emotional cognitive equipoise to make decisions in stressful and uncertain environments. I can think of so many examples. People who have affective disorder with the sun. Sunlight sets a certain level of our emotional state. And I'm going to meet with Ramachandran today. I'm anxious to talk to him about changing the set points for attention, hemiattentional defects, neglects, things like that. Anyway, set points are everywhere. Now, in the motor system, and to a certain extent in our sensory transduction systems, our systems work around a tonic level, a steady tonic level of tone, usually in what we call a push-pull mechanism or agonist-antagonist pairing. So one side goes up, the other side goes down. The idea is twofold. You want to be quiet when no movement is required. You need a null zone, you need a zero point, so you can easily detect differences going in either direction, detecting perturbations. And if you work around a push-pull mechanism, you have more linear range that movement can take place. So this allows for accurate movements to be launched from stable platforms. So we need muscle tone at a certain level, so that we can then launch quickly an accurate movement optimally. And then these mechanisms allow for compensation on the motor or the sensory side. Take an ocular muscle palsy, a sixth nerve palsy. You still can move the eye in the half the field of range because you have an antagonist whose activity can be modulated, the medial rectus on the other side. Or if you lose one labyrinth, you still have the other labyrinth which can modulate up or down, depending upon whether the head rotates toward or away from that side. So by working around a tonic level of tone, this puts the organism in good stead for adaptation. In the labyrinth, we have spontaneous nystagmus is a sign of a set point abnormality after a labyrinthectomy, or skew deviation. We talked about that earlier today. That's an otolith imbalance. You take out one labyrinth, your set points are off, you get nystagmus and vertical misalignment. Look at movement disorders like cervical dystonia. Head tremor actually can be viewed as a set point problem. The holding networks have been shifted. Wry neck in cervical dystonia. In eye movements, there are all kinds of set point abnormalities. I mentioned rebound nystagmus, null zones and congenital nystagmus. Strabismus can be viewed, cross eyes, as a set point problem. And in strokes, in Wallenberg syndrome, the eyes are deviated to one side. So set points are pervasive. We haven't studied them that much in terms of how we study motor behavior dynamically. Okay, here's just a few examples to give you an idea.
All right, just look straight ahead. You're doing great. I look to the right. Look at my finger.
Now watch when she comes back to center.
Look at the camera.
There's a nystagmus. This is an after effect, look at just the finger. Like the after effect in the
So there's a little magnet. Gaze of
it slowly dissipates.
Downbeat component.
She is resetting set
eyes
point
over there.
Of where straight ahead is toward one side, and you can see
now look at the camera.
Auditory cues and pointing.
And a set. Strong rebound nystagmus.
We saw this case earlier. Here's a set point strabismus, an ocular alignment set point problem with a pica. Posterior inferior cerebellar artery infarction, Wallenberg syndrome. You can see there's a skew deviation. One eye is higher than the other. It bops up and down when you change the fixating eye. This is a set point problem. Normally, tone is balanced and the eyes are aligned properly. You take out one labyrinth and there's an imbalance. We'll skip. This is also, I'll show it to you because it's such a cardinal feature of Wallenberg syndrome. They close their eyes and the eyes deviate over to one side. So the set point is deviated over to the left and they have to correct when they come back. Okay, so the last thing is our most recent work, which most of this was just published a couple months ago. Our issue, the question we addressed, how does the brain get rid of a sustained, unwanted, spontaneous vestibular nystagmus after losing labyrinthine function on one side? Otherwise, we could not see clearly when our head is still. We would be at a tremendous evolutionary disadvantage if after every little bit of imbalance in the labyrinth system, minor head injuries, whatever occurred, if you couldn't get rid of unwanted nystagmus. The eyes have to be still for us to see best. So we ask the question, how does the brain restore normal balance between the vestibular nuclei on either side of the brainstem? Remember, they're working in push-pull. So we decided or thought that MVS, which produces the almost a simulated vestibular imbalance, because it's a sustained nystagmus lasting minutes or hours, could we use that to test these adaptive capabilities in normal subjects? Now, an important caveat here. When you lose function in one labyrinth, the labyrinth is gone. There's no tone coming from there. In our MVS, there is a nystagmus like you have lost function on one side, or there's a big vestibular imbalance, but there still is information coming from both sides, albeit asymmetrically. So it's not a perfect model for a lesion-induced persistent imbalance, but nonetheless. So this is just points out this. It's you know the subject can lie there for 2 hours and have a vestibular nystagmus. Now you can't rotate someone around at a constant acceleration for 2 hours, or they'd be out at the moon after 2 hours, because constant accelerations create velocities that are not tolerable very quickly. And there are other ways. You could use ice water for a couple hours. That's not very pleasant. Galvanic stimulation, now that's getting better. You can do that without a tremendous amount of pain, but we don't know what we're really stimulating there. So this method has a real advantage in simulating a imbalance that would normally appear when there's a pathological lesion. Just remember, the vestibular system works in push-pull. One side goes up, the other side goes down. When you rotate, activity on one side goes up, activity on the other side goes down. And again, just to reiterate, this optimizes dynamic behavior for the reasons I said, but it puts the organism at risk for an unwanted imbalance between the two sides, which produces nystagmus. The brain has to get rid of a spontaneous nystagmus, restore equipoise, normal tone, to function optimally. So what are the early lines of defense? when that virus suddenly shuts off one nerve, what can the brain do to get rid of this nystagmus? Well, we have a visual fixation mechanism. I discussed that originally. That's how this whole thing got discovered, because we eliminated that, which will suppress nystagmus. The cardinal rule: peripheral vestibular lesions are suppressed by fixation. To reveal them, eliminate fixation. Put some glasses on and so they can't fixate. But that doesn't have a long-term, it's not a long-term solution, and it doesn't do well when the nystagmus is really fast or when it has torsional components. It's not a long-term solution. But there are short-term vestibular adaptation mechanisms. We already know about those because we see those in normal subjects when we do rotations, caloric nystagmus, head-shaking nystagmus. There are reversal phases after a patient shakes their head back and forth for 20 seconds. Or if you take a normal subject and put calorics on one side, you get this reversal phase. That's the same adaptation after effect that I showed you with magnetic vestibular stimulation. An archetypical classical central vestibular disorder is something called periodic alternating nystagmus. Every 2 minutes, the nystagmus changes direction. These are adaptive after effects. So there are lots of examples of these things. We know they exist. We know they come in quite early. And we also know that if you lose labyrinthine function, the cerebellum kicks in very early. So if you lose function on one side, how do you get better? You can bring function up on this side to restore balance, or acutely, you can just suppress the other side. And that's called the cerebellar clamp. The cerebellum shuts down the other side to restore balance. And this is why patients who have an acute vestibular problem on one side may have a decreased caloric response on the other side, because things have been turned down. That also is only a temporary solution, because if everything's turned off, you've lost push-pull. You don't have spontaneous nystagmus, but you're not optimal for actual behavior. So there are all these mechanisms, and we decided we wanted to study at least one of them, and that's this middle one, short-term vestibular adaptation. Now, this has been known for 45 years, and there were two beautiful studies in 1970 and 1969 which studied this short-term adaptation mechanism from Canada and from Boston. And what we have here is a subject is being rotated, constant head velocity, not a constant acceleration. And you know, if it's a constant velocity, the nystagmus decays away, and when you stop, it turns around. We've all done that when we were kids in a playground. Turn around and then stop and you'll fall. But if you just keep rotating someone at a constant speed, the nystagmus fades, but it actually transiently will go in the other direction. So this is the adaptation to this. Now, if you use a constant head acceleration, like an MVS, the nystagmus goes up, just like we saw in our original diagram. After a minute or so, it's up to here, but then it slowly starts to come back. This is on a chair, and then when you stop, you get an after effect. So you can do this on a chair for a short period of time, which is what this shows. And these guys, don't worry about the details here, they made models, circuit models of what's going on. They're very simple. It's just there's an adaptation system that feeds forward or feeds back, just like your temperature thermostat, to decrease the response. So these are what we call adaptation operators. You do something like this. You stand next to a wall and push hard for 30 seconds, and when you go out, your arm goes up. So these are all the same kind of principles. And they tested these models, analytically. If you can test something with mathematical equations, you really understand it. This is the data: constant velocity, constant acceleration, and these are their models. They're very simple models. They just have an adaptation network that feeds back and damps the response. Now, we could do this for a long period of time. So this is 90 minutes for a subject in the MRI scanner. And you can see the initial response, and then there's a relatively quick decay, and then a slower decay, and this is the after response. So we just very simply put in three different circuits with different time courses. So now we have circuit adaptation 1, circuit adaptation 2, circuit adaptation 3. We gave it the appropriate mathematical numbers for the time course of these things, and our data and simulations fit the real data perfectly. So this is with three different time courses, progressively longer and longer. This is a short time in the scanner. The green is the simulation. This is a long time in the scanner. So, you know, this is 25 minutes adaptation, 90 minutes adaptation. This doesn't tell us the mechanism, but at least we now have a tool to attack what's going on for these different adaptation time networks, because we can quantify the effects. So drugs, cerebellar patients, et cetera, et cetera. So you can make nice pictures of this and show how this is adaptation 1, this is adaptation 2, this is adaptation 3, and you can correlate how this nystagmus is gradually decaying away with these different adaptation. If you like Bayesian perspectives, you can apply that. We'll skip that. And interestingly, we discovered after we did our study that people have studied postural control, stepping around. You have a circle going round and round, a disc, and you step on it. And in order to keep from going on the disc, you have to keep going like this, in essence. You can study the time course of these postural effects, the same three time constants, So maybe it's common. We don't know. So the last quick point is, well, what's the brain using? How is the brain figuring out that there's this nystagmus? What are the air signals? Where do they come from? What structures provide air signals? So the first thing we discovered was that vision doesn't really affect the time constant of these adaptation, these early time constants. This is work we did on monkey a long time ago, same kind of experiment, did a labyrinthectomy and followed its loss of nystagmus, the recovery. With and without vision, it didn't make much difference whether the monkey could see or not see for recovery of balance. So the brain has to have some internal mechanisms. And we did this in our patient, and I think this is the last slide. Our normal subjects. So they're outside of the magnet, and there's hardly any nystagmus, and then they go into the magnet, and here is that nystagmus, and then we turn the lights on or left them off. With no lights, here's that nystagmus gradually decaying a little bit. With the light on, the nystagmus is suppressed, so you're not getting any nystagmus here. Then just before we take them out of the magnet, we turn the lights off for the one who had the lights on, and you can see the nystagmus is coming back. It's coming back. And then when they come out of the magnet in the dark, they both have the exact same after effect. So even though there was no nystagmus here, the brain was adapting to it anyway at virtually the same rate. So this is the end of the story. It's a simple method. We've learned a lot about homeostasis in the brain. We have some behavioral ways of monitoring these short-term adaptation processes. And our challenge now, of course, is to figure out what are the mechanisms. And they're not just little engineering boxes. They're changes in genetics, expression of messenger RNA, glial changes, there are inflammatory changes, there's neurogenesis. There are a whole bunch of things by which the brain restores balance and tone in the case of some kind of pathological abnormality. And our spiel is that MVS is a real nice way to study this very fundamental problem of how we maintain our equipoise. So that's that story.
When one looks at the slopes of, I guess it's operator 1 and 3, it's the initial response and then later re-adaptation. The slopes are very, very similar. It looks like the time courses are similar.
So actually, I don't know if I have a slide. So if you plot them on the same scale, the slopes are different. Yeah, so that's how we get the time constants. So there's one on the order of 80, 90 seconds. Then there's one on the order of minutes. And then there's one on the order of hours.
So I'm just guessing that that might be very, those time constants might be very sensitive to the underlying mechanism, exactly where, presumably, in the brainstem these changes occur.
So that's the key point. So we're starting to try and look at cerebellar patients now and find out which one of these adaptation operators is affected. I guess our emphasis is that we have at least a way to quantify this behavior and look at whatever kinds of experimental variability we want to induce.
Yeah, I didn't really quite get the range of Lorentz forces, but is it foreseeable that there are other magnetic fields like power lines?
Yeah,
so could have enough Lorentz forces.
So,
is
the North Pole going to do this kind of stuff? Why are birds going? And there are a lot. When I first heard this story, I said, oh, it must mean this is, you know, something in the inner ear. Lower animals have laguna, which is a magnetic field detector mechanism. So we don't have that. These forces are in the MRI machine are so much bigger than anything we experience naturally. I mean, you know, if you take your key off of a 7-Tesla magnet, you're going to get fired, basically, if you let go of it, because they're so powerful. Obviously, these forces are everywhere in the body. It's just this unbelievable coincidence that the utricle was here and the lateral canal was there, that everything lined up so that the direct action, the direction of these forces happened to go push towards the cupula. Now, there are other things when you are in a strong magnet. If you shake your head, you get funny tastes in your mouth. And try it sometime. And I guess the best evidence that it's actually affecting something on the chemotransduction, actually, in the taste receptors. If you look around, you see a little flash with every saccade. And probably it's a little tug on the optic nerve. You're getting a trance in Faraday forces. So, but the reason this rather striking effect occurs is because of the way nature put together the anatomy.
MRI papers would have to adjust for that. It's almost like the temperature in animal models. Is that like a fundamental law that possibly
so, could hurt people? So, you know, there's just recently there were some papers about functional imaging being useless. And then there, we've all known that for a while, though, but that's another issue. But then there was, it's an interesting story because of some statistical quirks, but it turns out the last few, there was controversy. You should read about this. It's an interesting story. So the only evidence directly to your question is a study that came out about 4 or 5 months ago from Germany, and they did resting state and showed that clearly the vestibular activation was affecting the vestibular cortical areas. As I said, you could probably check a patient very quickly and find a head position where they line up exactly and you don't have these forces. But we've been thinking of you know, big data, getting all these MRI resting state studies. And remember, too, that people lump all these studies together from different sites, and they're lumping magnets which are North Pole and magnets which are South Pole. That may not be a bad thing because that might, you know, average them out. So our caveat is, and it's taken about 5 years, you know, functional imaging people don't want to be told they're work doesn't mean anything. So it's taken a long time for them to at least think about this issue. And if they start doing functional imaging in 7-Tesla magnets, there's going to be, because this effect is really big in a 7T. And, you know, we're going to bigger 11T magnets. You know, these effects just scale linearly with the strength of the magnetic field.
Light in when you're doing a functional MRI change, this if the person is to adapt, showing, based on what you said at the end.
So could I show a change in functional?
Right.
Could. We don't know. I mean, you could take a patient who has a big nystagmus and a patient who has no nystagmus and find out, you know, what's different about that.
Did you come across at any point a new section with the transcranial magnetic stimulation, which people are using for various psychiatric
or... Right. So this is obviously, or, I mean, not obviously, it's quite different from transcranial magnetic stimulation. That's usually creating a little lesion in the brain temporarily. So it doesn't have much to do with the labyrinth. So this is a very, very different kind of phenomenon.
Do you see any conditioning response for
Long term.
Right. So
yeah.
If they were to do it, let's say, every day of the week for 2 hours, would that...
So we don't know about long term. People have studied long term effects of technicians working near these big magnets. The data is terrible. Nothing really definite has come out of that. My own feeling is this is not much different than, you know, being on a rotatory chair, you know, twice a week for a study, 6 or 7 times. The only piece of evidence I can tell you is that in our short-term experiments, if we take one person and put them in at 1 hour and then take them out, put them in at 3 hours, take them out, put them in the next day, there's no adaptation. They show the same response on those intervals. So this is a very robust phenomena. It's very consistent, at least in the terms that we've been looking at. And I encourage you, do you have a 7T here or 7 Tesla? Oh, if you don't believe me, just go over there. Just lie in there for a minute or so. And the perception is an interesting problem. That's where the Bayesian theory really comes in. Because when you're lying supine in a magnetic field and your canals are activated, your brain thinks you're rotating like on a barbecue spit. Okay. But the otolith organ isn't getting a changing gravity vector. So normally if you're on a barbecue spit, you would get a canal activation saying, hey, I'm rotating. And you would get an otolith activation saying, I'm rotating, because the gravity vector would change. In fact, the brain can extract rotation from a change in gravity vector. Here, there is no change in the gravity vector. So you're in a conflict situation, which is how it is for patients all the time. And that's why some patients have huge perceptual, motion sickness. Some patients don't get very sick. So the brain has to make a decision. Am I rotating or am I still? And, how that decision comes about is a great question. Doug?
Some of this could account for the varying degrees of claustrophobia that certain people have in their eyes. Admittedly, those are often 1.5 G, maybe 2 G.
Well, claustrophobia is a set point. I haven't thought about it, to be honest. But maybe we could, gradually change the size of the bore and figure out what your claustrophobia set point is. So
it would be a little less expensive if you didn't use the MRI machine to figure that out.
Oh yeah, I have to tell you, we're working with our physics friends to design a magnet. We don't care about pictures anymore, at least in this experiment. To design a magnet that we could use to stimulate the labyrinth at these relatively high strengths. We want to try and use that even therapeutically. It won't take too much time, but I'm very excited about this data that has come out that shows if you have a stroke in a rat experimentally, the rat will cover, let's say, use of that paw to a certain degree. But then if you have a stroke in another part of the brain, there'll be further recovery on that original stroke side. So there's a signal. Somehow, I've been damaged, and it's a nonspecific generalized signal, which engages all the adaptive mechanisms again. So we figure we can create these artificial lesions in dizzy patients and then incorporate that with physical therapy. It's just an idea, but why not? Okay.